Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Well, folks, this week's episode is another greatest hits episode where I curate some of the best news stories that are both timely and timeless. So let's do this. From Stat News, moral injury and burnout in medicine. Moral injury describes the mental, emotional, and spiritual distress people feel after perpetrating, failing to prevent, or bearing witness to acts that transgress deeply held moral beliefs and expectations. It was originally described by VA clinicians to account for the way that the suffering of some military veterans did not respond to standard treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. This way of conceptualizing soldiers' suffering felt deeply familiar to us, and we thought it might provide a compelling account of the cause of the burnout we have witnessed in our colleagues and ourselves. The concept of moral injury allows clinicians to express what the burnout label failed to describe, the agony of being constantly locked in double binds when every choice one makes yields a compromised outcome, and when each decision contravenes the reason for years of sacrifice. All of us who work in healthcare share, at least in the abstract, a single mission: to promote health and take care of the ill and injured. That's what we are trained to do. But the business of healthcare, the gigantic system of administrative machinery in which healthcare is delivered, documented, and reimbursed, keeps us from pursuing that mission without anguish or conflict. We do our best to put patients first, but constantly watch the imperatives of business trump the imperative of healing. Day after day, healthcare professionals find themselves with no viable choice but to act in ways that transgress their deeply held beliefs in the primacy of care. As a result, many experience the well-understood symptoms of burnout, and they keep burning out, in defiance of the many and well-meaning interventions designed to combat it. The burnout epidemic continues unabated because the moral injury at the root of the problem remains unaddressed. Burnout may be the symptom, but in many cases, moral injury is the cause. We have learned that moral injury resonates because it suggests a broadly shared cause for the seemingly solitary experience of burnout. In other words, moral injury lets us understand that we are burned out as individuals because each of us is trying in vain to compensate for the dysfunctional way healthcare is structured for everyone. Those who suffer from moral injury in healthcare are desperate for healing. How do we do that? Each of us has been trying to fix the system on our own, in our own individual ways. Now it is time to work together to that end. Clinicians get burned out because healthcare is rife with double binds and no-win situations for clinicians, and the patients we care for. Changing that system to make it less harmful will demand collective action from everyone called by conscience to do better. When an individual falls ill, her or his clinician looks for the cause of the problem and its corresponding medical solution. We need to approach moral injury in the same way, knowing full well that the solutions aren't medical, but are social, economic, and political. The conversation around moral injury, then, summons clinicians to look outside their own expertise to heal the system that is harming themselves, their colleagues, and their patients. The solutions to heal moral injury don't look much like the medical interventions we are used to. They are more likely to come from the toolkits of epidemiology and public health, public policy and law, and grassroots organizing. Advocating effectively for the sweeping changes desperately needed in healthcare requires healthcare professionals to look in other places for inspiration and to work together toward a common goal. Industry constraints affect every healthcare professional in some way, and we must be united with each other and with patients to drive the changes we believe are necessary. When we boil the ocean of healthcare down to its single organizing principle, all healthcare professionals, nurses, doctors, first responders, physical therapists, respiratory therapists, phlebotomists, technologists, and more are in this together with a single goal to provide the best care for patients. When we get back to this, we all win. Okay, next up from the Hill. Sexual trauma is a global public health issue. A recent study published in one of the premier journals of the American Medical Association indicates that 6.5% of women in the United States experience their first sexual intercourse through physical force or coercion. Using a population-based sample of over 13,000 American women between the ages of 18 and 44 and appropriate statistical weighting, researchers say this means that more than 3.3 million reproductive age women nationwide experience forced intercourse as their sexual initiation. That number is jaw-dropping. As a trauma psychologist, this to me further highlights the imperative for public health measures and socioculture changes to prevent sexual violence. Until recently, a lot of the research on forced sexual initiation was conducted outside the U.S. This new investigation, however, definitively shows that forced sexual initiation happens here as well. In addition, this study documents that those who experience their first sexual encounter as forced have serious subsequent negative health consequences, including reproductive and gynecologic issues. These women are more likely to develop painful pelvic conditions, such as inflammatory diseases or endometriosis, experience unwanted first pregnancies or abortions, and have problems with ovulation or menstruation. Coerced or forced sexual initiation in women has also been associated with higher rates of HIV, sexually transmitted diseases, and intercourse with multiple and high-risk sexual partners. It should also be no secret after the Me Too movement that sexual violence, including sexual harassment and non-penetrative sexual assault and rape, is highly linked to serious mental health outcomes. This includes, but is not limited to, post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, substance abuse, eating disorders, and suicidal thoughts and behaviors. It's not alarmist to say that forced sexual initiation and other forms of sexual violence can affect girls and women for the rest of their lives. It affects how they see themselves and how they expect others to treat them in relationships. Dr. Nicole Nugent, an internationally recognized child clinical psychologist and associate professor at Brown University, has worked with this population for many years. She said it breaks your heart to hear their stories. Girls who have been sexually violated say things like, "I'm dirty and no one will ever want to date or marry me." I've seen many of these girls pick unhealthy dating partners in their futures because they believe they are not deserving of being with a good and kind person. Dr. Nugent further explained, some of these girls have a very hard time believing that forced sexual initiation was rape. They say things like, I didn't want to lose my virginity that way. It's not uncommon that their perceptions about this traumatic experience become twisted in their mind. Sexual violence is something that is hard to digest in the psyche. Its effects linger. For example, the moment someone touches them, even in a loving way, they shut down and freeze. Oftentimes, these trauma responses make it much more difficult for women to engage in safe sex negotiations and with future partners. Sadly, not having these skills or not believing the skills should be put in place almost sets women up for re-victimization. Clearly, we need to improve the physical and mental health care of women and men who have been sexually assaulted in this country. But we also desperately need public health policies and programs aimed at reducing forced sexual initiation and other forms of sexual violence across the lifespan. Center for Disease Control and Prevention has been strongly promoting the dissemination of programs that address sexual culture and violence prevention skills. It'd be prudent for our country's health systems to invest in developing and implementing evidence-informed prevention approaches. We need programs, policies, and practices that promote social norms that protect against violence, like bystander approaches. These involve people being taught to recognize behavior that puts others at risk for sexual violence, and then how to take appropriate steps to safety and effectively intervene. I wish it was easy as waving a magic wand to make the world a better place. One of the most difficult problems that I wish could quickly and easily be solved would be to positively shape relationship skills. What if we all received some really key social and emotional skills focused on empathy, conflict management, and communication at an appropriate age? What if all of us gained a firm understanding on what makes for healthy dating and marital relationships, including sharing power and respecting one another's boundaries? Wouldn't it be amazing if we were all taught the basics of healthy sexuality, and that it's normal and acceptable for women to initiate and decline sexual intercourse? This recent study illuminating the rates and some of the effects of forced sexual initiation in American women adds to the decades of research on sexual violence. Too many women and men across cultures and societies encounter sexual violence. It's a global public health issue that increases people's vulnerability to a host of physical, psychological, and social difficulties. We must do something to implement best practice interventions and policies to prevent and address this widespread problem. Okay, next up from The Intercept, war on the world. It may not come as a surprise that the largest industrial military in the history of the world is also the single biggest polluter on the planet. A recent study from Brown University's Costs of War Project surfaced this startling fact. The U.S. Department of Defense has a larger annual carbon footprint than most countries on Earth. With a sprawling network of bases and logistics networks, the U.S. military is the single biggest emitter of carbon dioxide in the world, aside from whole nation states themselves. Indeed, the Department of Defense is the world's largest institutional user of petroleum and correspondingly the single largest producer of greenhouse gases in the world. If the Pentagon were a country, it would be the world's 55th largest emitter of carbon dioxide, and its main purpose, warfare, is easily its most carbon-intensive activity. Since the present era of American conflicts began with the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001, the U.S. military is estimated to have emitted a staggering 1.2 billion tons of carbon into the atmosphere. For comparison, the entire annual carbon emissions of the United Kingdom is roughly 360 million tons. That massive additional burden on the planet might be justifiable were it all being done in the name of vital national security interests, but the biggest components of the U.S. military's carbon dioxide footprint have been in wars and occupations that were almost entirely unnecessary. To put it crudely, the U.S. poisoned the planet for vanity projects. In addition to emitting millions of tons of carbon dioxide during the war, the U.S. military footprint contributed more directly to the immediate destruction of the Afghan environment. Deforestation has accelerated amid the chaos of the war, and through trash burning and other means, the U.S. armed forces release toxic pollutants into the air that are blamed for sickening Afghan civilians and causing chronic illnesses among U.S. veterans. The environmental havoc wreaked by the war in Iraq has been even worse. Not only did the war lead to a spike in carbon dioxide emissions through the U.S. military activity, it resulted in the widespread poisoning of the Iraqi environment through the use of toxic munitions and the same so-called burn pits on military bases that were used in Afghanistan. The environment has become so toxic in some places that it has led to elevated rates of cancer, as well as crippling birth defects, terrible individual punishments inflicted on innocent future generations. A British doctor who co-authored two studies on the environmental impact of U.S. military operations in Fallujah said that the city's population suffers the highest rate of genetic damage in any population ever studied. Much of this impact can be blamed on the use of depleted uranium munitions by the U.S. forces. Despite vowing to cease their use, a study by the independent monitoring group Air Wars and Foreign Policy magazine found that the military continued to use the toxic munitions during its most recent bombing campaign in Syria. The fact that fossil fuel emissions have been the major driver of climate change adds another grim irony to these wars. For decades, the heavy U.S. military footprints in the Middle East has been justified by the need to preserve access to the region's oil preserves. The industrial extraction of those same reserves has been one of the major drivers of global carbon dioxide emissions. In other words, we have been killing, dying, and polluting to ensure our access to the same toxic resource most responsible for our climate disruption. It took this perfect symmetry between industrial warfare and industrial exploitation of the earth to bring about the unspeakable emergency we now face. Ironically, given its own role in helping create this emergency, the Pentagon happens to be one of the few redoubts from the climate denialism now gripping the American government. The only department in Washington that is clearly and completely seized with the idea that climate change is real is the Department of Defense, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, former chief and staff to General Colin Powell, has said. The U.S. military is preparing for a grim future of climate-caused political instability, food shortages, resource wars, and massive refugee flows. Recognizing the strategic threat posed by its own dependence on fossil fuel, it has even taken steps to diversify its energy sources. Yet even these limited efforts have met pushback from the Trump administration. The Navy recently killed a task force created to study the effects of climate change, undermining a bare minimum effort to forecast the impact of rising seas and melting ice caps. In the words of the former Rear Admiral who led the Navy's climate change efforts until 2015, the task force ended, in my opinion, without full incorporation of climate change considerations. The melting of the Arctic is not just creating an ecological emergency, but in the eyes of American, Russian, and Chinese military commanders, it is also creating a potential new battleground. Faced with a planet that is clearly at the limits of the abuse it can take, the groundwork is still being laid for more exploitation and violence. Okay, and sticking with the theme of the Defense Department, this from MLive.com, 15 U.S. governors lobby for provisions on toxic chemicals in defense bill. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine and 14 other U.S. state governors are lobbying Congress to include provisions that would establish strong national regulations around pollution from chemicals called PFAS in the latest must-pass defense bill. The September 18th letter, signed by 4 Republican and 11 Democratic governors, urged the U.S. Senate and House Armed Services Committees to include multiple PFAS-related provisions in the final version of the National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2020. The issue is being tied to defense spending in part because of the military's lengthy and widespread use of PFAS in firefighting foam, a practice that has caused contamination at more than 400 U.S. defense facilities around the world. The governors note that several U.S. states have already or are presently developing their own state-specific laws on PFAS in the absence of enforceable national standards. PFAS are a large group of industrial chemicals, highly prized for their durability and power to repel water, grease, and withstand high temperatures. The chemistry has been used in products, things like food packaging, Teflon nonstick cookware, Scotchgard fabric protector, and firefighting foams. In the decades since the initial development, PFAS chemicals have contaminated the groundwater, soil, and surface waters of many states. Exposure to the chemicals has been linked in human studies to certain cancers, thyroid malfunction, and other chronic diseases. The advocacy nonprofit Environmental Working Group estimates the chemicals have been found in 712 sites in 49 states. If designated as hazardous substances under the federal Superfund law, the EPA would have greater authority to order and enforce cleanups at PFAS contaminated sites, as well as recover remediation costs from polluters. Okay, and with the climate change issue, another issue with public health, this from publicintegrity.org, man versus mosquito at the front lines of a public health war. Mosquito-borne illnesses like Zika have increased almost tenfold nationally from 2004 to 2016, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. That's put local governments at the front lines of a contentious public health war, one that climate change will only worsen. A 2016 report by Climate Central found warming temperatures coupled with more humid days having elongated mosquito seasons. The insect's range has also expanded. Aedes aegypti, the species that transmits Zika, dengue, yellow fever, and chikungunya, has moved northward in the U.S. by roughly 150 miles per year. By 2050, researchers predict almost half the world's population will be exposed to at least one of two major disease-carrying mosquitoes. Scientists are also concerned about the growing threat of resistance, which undercuts the effectiveness of insecticides. Mosquitoes are not a new enemy. Historian Timothy Weingart estimated in a 2019 book that the winged insects have killed more than 52 billion people, making them humanity's deadliest predator, with far more casualties than all recorded wars combined. Malaria, now seen as a mostly tropical disease, was rampant in the U.S. until a federal program run by an early version of the CDC eliminated the illness domestically by 1951. That program made heavy use of DDT, a now banned insecticide that is toxic to mosquitoes, but also to birds, bees, and humans. Today, the Herculean task of managing and tracking mosquitoes falls largely to local mosquito control districts. These little-known entities can operate as standalone agencies funded through special taxes or as divisions within health or agricultural departments. Vast differences in budgets, scientific expertise, and policy mean mosquito control in the U.S. can vary widely from one location to the next. Districts also have to strike a tough balance between safeguarding communities and weighing concerns from environmentalists about the ecological impacts of insecticides. But districts hampered by a lack of resources and authority may be unable to do much beyond spraying, and only after an infection is detected. We need to the help of politicians and public health officials to recognize our job is not response, it's prevention. And one note with that, for those of you in Lucas County, here in Toledo, we do have what's considered a more advanced and better funded mosquito control district. Although when that thing comes buzzing by your street, you hear that thing letting out that fog of insecticide, you might want to close your windows. This from Science Daily. Racial stereotypes may play a role with assumptions that African Americans are more violent, study finds. People are more likely to blame violent video games as a cause of several shootings by white perpetrators than by African American perpetrators, possibly because of racial stereotypes that associate minorities with violent crime, according to new research published by the American Psychological Association. Researchers analyzed more than 200,000 news articles about 204 mass shootings over a 40-year period and found that video games were 8 times more likely to be mentioned when the shooting occurred at a school and the perpetrator was a white male rather than the shooter was an African-American male. Another experiment conducted with college students had similar findings. When a violent act is carried out by someone who doesn't match the racial stereotype of what a violent person looks like, people tend to seek an external explanation of the violent behavior, said lead researcher Patrick Markey, a psychology professor at Villanova University. When a white child from the suburbs commits a horrific violent act like a school shooting, then people are more likely to erroneously blame video games than if a child was African American. Numerous scientific studies have found a link between violent video games and mass shootings, but some politicians and media coverage often cite violent video games as a potential cause, particularly for school shootings. Video games are often associated with young people, even though the average age of players is in the 30s. Video games are often used by lawmakers and others as a red herring to distract from other potential causes of school shootings. When a shooter is a young white male, we talk about violent video games as a cause for the shooting. When the shooter is an older man or African American, we don't. Blaming violent video games for school shootings by white perpetrators could be a sign of a larger racial issue where African American perpetrators are assigned a greater degree of culpability for their crimes, which could lead to unfair treatment in the justice system. Well, imagine that. You don't have to. Okay, and in a riff on racism in health, this from the American Public Health Association, 400 years since Jamestown, an American Journal of Public Health dossier, marking their October 2019 special issue. The special section marks an important but troubling anniversary in U.S. history, the arrival in October 1619 of 20 unfree African laborers who were brought as indentured servants. By the 1660s, indentured servants were displaced and numerically overwhelmed by African slaves who, over the next 2 centuries, helped build the U.S. economy through the institution of chattel slavery. The 6 contributions to the section take on the challenge of making sense of the 400 years since October 1619 by exploring how slavery and its continuing legacies have shaped U.S. medicine and public health, especially with regard to persisting racial biases and health disparities that show improvement over time but refuse to disappear. The authors of these contributions are a mix of outstanding older and younger scholars, mostly historians, who have probed the legacies of slavery at various critical moments up to the present. Their analyses are alert to the roles played by overt racial ideology and covert biases, first in providing a justification for slavery, second in rationalizing horrific conditions of labor, third in exploiting the white power physicians exercise over black bodies, and finally in creating an intellectual framework of essential racial difference that had medical and health consequences that persist to this day. Stephen Thomas and Erica Casper note that medical historians have documented how Southern physicians claimed that blacks were medically different from whites and required, quote, special treatment, thus providing the facade of medical authority supporting the prevailing wisdom that people of African descent derived from a species other than human and as such could be justifiably used as chattel. Alan Derrickson traces 20th century practices of channeling black workers into the hot jobs back to mid-19th century physicians' justifications of the exposure of slaves to long, brutal days in the hot summer sun because the Negro was supposedly organically constituted to be an agricultural laborer in tropical climates. Deirdre Cooper Owens and Charlotte Fett show how medical professionals perform such functions as determining the market and insurance value of black bodies and attended to the reproductive lives of enslaved women to maximize, quote, birth yield. Rana Hogarth, in two related contributions, demonstrates how racist beliefs even influence anti-slavery Northern physician Benjamin Rush, who believed that innate racial differences would protect Philadelphia's free black community if they volunteered to put themselves in harm's way during the 1793 yellow fever epidemic. All these scholars connect these earlier moments of racial bias and blindness to recent studies that suggest the persistence of deep, now largely unconscious racial biases that very likely account for the consistent finding that contemporary medical students, residents, and seasoned practitioners believe that blacks feel less pain than do whites and are less likely to need certain cardiac medications, kidney dialysis, or bypass surgery. The contributors to the section are not consistently bleak, however, and offer some rays of hope for the future. Evelyn Hammonds and Susan Reverby highlight the efforts of blacks beginning in the late 19th century to make demands on local and federal governments, create mutual aid societies, and develop separate medical and nursing schools under their own control. These efforts expanded in the 20th century with the promotion of National Negro Health Week, the engagement of black churches, and the organization of black women's groups. Cooper, Owens, and Fett also point to important examples of community empowerment regarding health issues in the 1960s and 70s and to more recent initiatives in critical self-assessment by health professionals. Let us hope that when the future generations look back at 2019, they will agree that Hammonds and Reverby and Cooper, Owens, and Fett had good cause for optimism. And now for something completely different. Okay, and as summer winds down, I wanted to do this story from the Chesterfield Observer. A changing lawnscape. As environmentalism goes mainstream, Americans' obsession with the lawn is cooling. Along with a car, a split-level house, and 2.4 children, a beautiful lawn is part of the idealized suburban American dream. Without it, what would be the point of sectioning off your yard with a white picket fence? And keeping up a lawn is a point of civic pride, showing that a homeowner cares about their community and social standing. But in recent decades, the traditional lawn has slowly come under siege. Criticism of the environmental impacts of the lawn, its costs, and the amount of time spent maintaining it have spread like so much crabgrass. Not only does sustaining a green lawn waste water, but people tend to put too much herbicides and pesticides on their lawns, leading to toxic runoff that pollutes waterways and poisons fish. The EPA states that our nation's grass requires 9 billion gallons of water a day to keep green, with nearly a third of all residential water use going towards landscaping. American households spread more herbicides per acre on their lawns than most farmers spread to grow crops. According to Ted Steinberg's book, American Green, approximately 7 million birds die each year because of lawn care pesticides. Revelations like these have led some homeowners to reimagine what their lawn means to them. Some have done away with turf grass entirely, letting other ground cover like clover and moss take over. Some have simply diminished the amount of turf grass they take care of, supplanting it with mulch and environmentally friendly native vegetation. While the idea that a lawn might not be the wisest use of a yard is nothing new, it's gaining more traction in this era of renewed environmental concern around climate change. As cultural values shift, what a lawn says about Americans as a people is changing too. In the suburbs, a turf war over grass and its place in our culture is leading to a reevaluation of what was previously considered a standard part of home ownership. Like a cowboy in the movies, it cherishes, America stands alone when it comes to its lawn obsession. In the United States, the lawn has become entwined with our sacrosanct ideals of freedom and property rights. Get off my lawn is a cliche for a reason. Grass is no small part of our culture. In 2005, a NASA study using satellite imagery found that there were 440 million acres of lawn in the lower 48, meaning that turf grass took up about three times as much area as irrigated corn. That same year, turf grasses were the single largest irrigated crop in America. But the problems of the lawn aren't merely aesthetic ones. Many chemicals applied to lawns have a lengthy history of harming plants, animals, and humans in some cases. Fertilizer runoff contaminates streams and lakes, leading to algae blooms and polluting drinking water. Lawn chemicals often make their way into homes, building up in carpets, and putting small children at risk of exposure to toxins. Though there's the environmental impact of lawn care, then there's the environmental impact of lawn care machinery, which burns fossil fuels. Though new EPA regulations have been put into place to help reduce emissions, a 2001 study showed that lawnmowers produce the same amount of pollution in one hour as driving a 1992 model vehicle for 650 miles. The use of a gas-powered leaf blower for 30 minutes emits as much hydrocarbon emissions as driving a car 7,700 miles at 30 miles per hour. And there's a direct physical impact on humans, too. According to the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission, more than 86,000 adults and 4,500 children were treated in emergency rooms in 2016 for lawnmower-related injuries. Okay, next up, some more good news, hopefully, from Science Daily. Cultivating joy through mindfulness, an antidote to opioid misuse, the disease of despair. New research shows that a specific mind-body therapy, mindfulness-oriented recovery enhancement, or MORE, increases the brain's response to natural, healthy rewards while also decreasing the brain's response to opioid-related cues. The results showed that over the course of the study, the brains of the study participants in the MORE group became significantly less reactive to cues related to their opioid medications, while also becoming significantly more responsive when participants used mindfulness to savor natural pleasure. Previous research shows that prolonged use of opioids makes our brains more sensitive to pain and less receptive to the joy one might normally experience from natural rewards, like spending time with loved ones or appreciating a beautiful sunset, explained Eric Garland, Associate Dean for Research at the University of Utah College of Social Work and lead author of the study. This blunted ability to experience natural positive feelings leads people to take higher and higher doses of opioids just to feel okay, and ultimately propels a downward spiral of opioid dependence and misuse. Because of this downward spiral, scholars are increasingly referring to chronic pain and opioid disuse as diseases of despair. The results of the study show that MORE can actually reverse that devastating trajectory. In addition to these objective EEG findings, participants in MORE also reported feeling enhanced joy and more meaning in life, results which Garland detailed in a paper published earlier this month in the Journal of Consulting and Clinical Psychology. They also reported experiencing significantly less pain and greater positive psychological health, that is, positive emotions, the ability to savor natural pleasure and self-transcendence, than those in a support group. The study concluded that 3 months after treatment, MORE reduced risk of opioid misuse by increasing positive psychological health and decreasing pain. Garland developed MORE as an integrative mind-body therapy designed to promote positive psychological health while simultaneously addressing addiction, pain, and stress. MORE teaches mental training techniques to help people to find meaning in the face of adversity while simultaneously alleviating physical and emotional pain by cultivating positive feelings and experiences. MORE teaches people to better notice, appreciate, and amplify the good things in life, while also deriving meaning and value from difficult situations. Taken together, these studies indicate that by changing brain function and promoting positive psychological health, MORE may increase happiness and enhance sense of meaningfulness in the face of adversity. These positive psychological effects, in turn, appear to reduce pain and prevent the misuse of opioids. Thus, enhancing joy and meaning in life through mindfulness may be an antidote to diseases of despair. It is estimated that approximately 20 to 30% of U.S. adults experience chronic pain. Opioid painkillers are often prescribed to these patients, but a quarter of those who take these powerful drugs long-term end up misusing them, with opioids accounting for 63% of all drug overdose deaths in 2015. The widespread misuse of this class of drugs has been deemed a public health crisis. Our nation's opioid crisis kills more than 100 people a day, so it is critical that we develop new and effective ways to prevent opioid misuse. The data shows that more can play that key role. Okay, and another law enforcement related story from Kaiser Health News, taking the cops out of mental health related 9/11 rescues. Over 8 million people struggle with schizophrenia or bipolar disorder in America, and an estimated 40% of people diagnosed with schizophrenia go untreated, according to the Treatment Advocacy Center, a nonprofit focused on mental health. Individuals with those illnesses often lose the ability to realize their deficits, creating a roadblock in accessing care and attending medical or court appointments. Low-level offenses can land those with paranoia, hallucinations, or a reduced ability to communicate in the criminal justice system. An estimated 383,000 people with severe mental illnesses are behind bars nationwide, while only a tenth of that number are in state hospitals. 1 in 4 deaths from police shootings represent people with mental illness, according to the Treatment Advocacy Center. People with severe mental illness are more than 10 times more likely to be victims of a violent crime than the general population, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Nationally, police officers carry the brunt of responding to mental health issues. In 2017, law enforcement agencies spent $918 million transporting people with severe mental illnesses, according to a 2019 survey from the Treatment Advocacy Center. It also estimated that officers spend 21% of their time responding to and transferring people for mental health issues. We need to start dealing with mental health issues, not as a law enforcement issue, but as a public health issue. Okay, and also sticking somewhat with the law enforcement and health connection, here we got from ProPublica, which is an investigative reporting organization. When medical debt collectors decide who gets arrested. Across the country, thousands of people are jailed each year for failing to appear in court for unpaid bills, an arrangement set up much like this one. The practice spread in the wake of the recession as collectors found judges willing to use their broad powers of contempt to wield the threat of arrest. Judges have issued warrants for people who owe money to landlords and payday lenders, who never paid off furniture or daycare fees or federal student loans. Some debtors who have been arrested owed as little as $28. More than half of the debt in collection stems from medical care, which, unlike most other debt, is often taken on without a choice or an understanding of the costs. Since the Affordable Act of 2010, insurers have nearly tripled deductibles, the amount a person pays before their coverage kicks in, and raised premiums and copays as well. As a result, tens of millions of people without adequate coverage are expected to pay larger portions of their rising bills. The sickest patients are often the most indebted, and they're not exempt from arrest. In Indiana, a cancer patient was hauled away from home in her pajamas in front of her 3 children. Too weak to climb down the stairs to the women's area of the jail, she spent the night in a men's mental health unit where an inmate smeared feces on the wall. In Utah, a man who had ignored orders to appear over an unpaid ambulance bill told friends he would rather die than go to jail. The day he was arrested, he snuck poison into the cell and ended his life. In jurisdictions with lax laws and willing judges, jail is a logical endpoint of a system that has automated the steps from high bills to debt to court, and that has given collectors power that is often unchecked. With hardly any oversight, even by the presiding judge, collection attorneys have turned this courtroom into a government-sanctioned shakedown of the uninsured and underinsured, while the leverage is the debtor's liberty. Allowing bail money to count towards collections raises some of the most critical legal questions. Peter Holland, a former director of the Consumer Protection Clinic at the University of Maryland Law School, explained that this practice reveals that jailing is not about contempt, but about collection. Most judges will tell you, "I'm working for the rule of law, and if you don't show up and you were summoned, there have to be consequences." He explained, "But the proof is in the pudding. If the judge is upholding the law, he would give the bail money back to you when you appear in court. Instead, he is using his power to take money from you and hand it to the debt collector. It raises constitutional questions." Congress has not acted on advocates' calls to amend the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act to prohibit collectors from requesting warrants. There are also no current efforts to bar nonprofit hospitals or medical providers that receive funds through Medicare or Medicaid from seeking warrants. Some states have reformed their laws to make sure defendants are properly served or to prohibit wage garnishments for debt, but legal experts on collections say that more remains to be done, like taking jail out of the equation and instead requiring debtors to sign a financial affidavit or a promise to appear. Debt collection is an $11 billion industry involving nearly 8,000 firms across the country. Medical debt makes up almost half of what's collected each year. Today, millions of debt collection suits are overwhelming state courts. The practice is considered a race of the diligent, where every creditor is rushing to the courthouse, hustling to get the first judgment in order to be the first to collect on a debtor's assets. Well, that's a pernicious intersection of our crappy law enforcement and court system with a crappy healthcare system that drives people into debt. Okay, next up from Science Daily. And this story, I think, is a really good example of why the concern for inequalities is at the heart of public health practice. Children's risk of dying before age 5 varies more than 40-fold. An unprecedented study mapping child deaths over almost 2 decades finds that nearly half of the 5.4 million under 5 years of age deaths in 2017 can be attributed to differences in child death rates within and across countries. The study is the first of its kind, mapping child deaths in 99 low- and middle-income countries at the level of individual districts. Published in the journal Nature, the finding includes precision maps illuminating health disparities within countries and regions, often obscured by national-level analysis. An interactive visualization accompanying the research compares child death rates from year to year. The research, conducted by the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington School of Medicine, looks at countries where more than 90% of child deaths occurred in 2017. Mortality rates varied as much as tenfold between districts within a country. Across all countries studied, the likelihood of a child dying before age varied more than 40-fold at the district level. It is as reprehensible as it is tragic that, on average, nearly 15,000 children under age 5 die every day, said Dr. Simon Hay, the senior author of the study and director of the local burden of disease group. Why are some areas doing so well while others struggle? In order to make progress, we need to enable precise targeting interventions, such as vaccines. Our findings provide a platform for nation's health ministers, clinicians, and others to make focused improvements in health systems. Globally, approximately 5.4 million children died before their 5th birthdays in 2017, as compared to 9.7 million in 2000. Researchers estimated that if every district in the low- and middle-income countries studied had met the Sustainable Development Goal target of at least as low as 25 child deaths per 1,000 live births, 2.6 million fewer children would have died. The vast majority of the 17,554 districts among the 99 nations studied saw improvement in lowering child deaths, but levels of inequality between districts were more variable over the study period. Despite major gains in reducing child deaths over the past 20 years, the highest rates of death in 2017 were still largely concentrated where rates were highest in 2000. And one interesting and encouraging finding is that in 43 countries studied, the district with the worst child mortality rate in 2017 was still better than the district with the best child mortality rate in 2000. Progress, but very uneven. So goes public health problems. Also from Science Daily, a very good study about a common practice or treatment, high blood pressure, and gives us a very simple way to make it more effective. This also from Science Daily. Largest study finds greater reduction in risk of cardiovascular disease and death from bedtime rather than morning medication. People with high blood pressure who take all their antihypertensive medication in one go at bedtime have better controlled blood pressure and a significantly lower risk of death or illness caused by heart or blood vessel problems compared to those who take their medication in the morning, according to new research. The researchers, who are part of the Hygieia Project, led by Professor Ramon Hermida, director of the Bioengineering Chronobiology Labs at the University of Vigo, Spain, found that patients who took their medication at bedtime had nearly half the risk, a 45% reduction, of dying from or suffering heart attacks, myocardial infarction, stroke, heart failure, or requiring a procedure to unblock narrowed arteries, compared to patients who took their medication on waking. The researchers had adjusted their analysis to take account of factors that could affect the results, such as age, gender, type 2 diabetes, kidney disease, smoking, and cholesterol levels. When they looked at individual outcomes, they found that the risk of death from heart or blood vessel problems was reduced by 66%. The risk of myocardial infarction was reduced by 44%, coronary revascularization by 40%, heart failure by 42%, and stroke by 49%. Professor Hermida said, "Current guidelines on the treatment of hypertension do not mention or recommend any preferred treatment time. Morning ingestion has been the most common recommendation by physicians based on the misleading goal of reducing morning blood pressure levels. However, the Hygieia Project has reported previously that average systolic blood pressure when a person is asleep is the most significant and independent indication of cardiovascular disease risk, regardless of blood pressure measurements taken while awake or when visiting a doctor. Furthermore, there are no studies showing that treating hypertension in the morning improves a reduction in the risk of cardiovascular disease. The results of this study show that patients who routinely take their antihypertensive medication at bedtime, as opposed to when they wake up, have better controlled blood pressure and, most importantly, a significantly decreased risk of death or illness from heart and blood vessel problems." From Stat News, the cancer growing in cancer medicine. Pharma money paid to doctors. Americans are rightly furious about the high and unsustainable price of cancer drugs, which now routinely cost more than $100,000 per year of therapy. These prices are made worse by the fact that most cancer drugs offer only modest benefits. One study put the median benefit at 2.1 extra months of life, along with the fact that expert physicians frequently recommend these drugs for off-label uses, meaning using a drug for a purpose it was not initially approved for. The House of Representatives, the Senate, presidential candidates, and even the president have floated proposals to tackle drug prices. While all contain good ideas, none address one of the elephants in the room, the experts who tell doctors how to use these medications. Expert physicians play an oversized role in cancer medicine. They write the editorials in major medical journals that can influence physicians' prescribing practices. They give educational sessions at national meetings, and they decide what evidence is good enough for off-label use. Spoiler alert, the evidence is often weak. All of this might be fine if experts offered neutral or unbiased information, but evidence suggests they do not. One study found that 85% of the experts who wrote widely used cancer guidelines had received payments averaging more than $10,000 from pharmaceutical companies. These guidelines mandate that Medicare pay for off-label use of cancer drugs. Research also showed that physicians who consistently put pharmaceutical money in their bank accounts are more likely to prescribe that company's drugs. Financial conflict of interest in cancer medicine matters. The pharmaceutical industry is run by intelligent people who choose to pay physicians millions of dollars. It is hard to believe that they have not calculated that this aids their bottom lines. Within the profession, there is little interest in reform. Our rules, our suggestions, our punishments lack teeth. Last year, Dr. Jose Baselga, the physician-in-chief at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, was found to have violated the disclosure policies of several medical journals across dozens of publications. Baselga resigned from his position, but his, quote, punishment lasted only 116 days before he was named executive vice president of AstraZeneca, a prominent and coveted industry position. The fundamental problem is that, as a profession, cancer physicians are not interested in addressing conflict of interest. Too many people in prominent positions benefit from the current lax policies. Disclosure is not the solution. Ending these payments is. I want to be clear. I'm all for doctors interacting with and working with the pharmaceutical and device industries. I have lectured at major pharmaceutical companies, but without accepting money, travel expenses, or meals. Researchers should be free to work with pharmaceutical companies on trials, but there is no legitimate reason why well-paid physicians need to take personal payments, gifts, meals, or travel expenses from the pharmaceutical industry. That practice must end. Conflict of interest is the cancer growing in cancer medicine. It poisons the field. It leads us to celebrate marginal drugs as if they were game changers. It leads experts to ignore or downplay flaws and deficits in cancer clinical trials. It keeps doctors silent about the crushing price of cancer medicines. It is rampant in guidelines that lead to off-label prescribing and that mandate payment. It is surely a calculated maneuver by the industry to increase their profits. The Sunshine Clause of the Affordable Care Act, which requires listing industry payments to physicians on the Open Payments website, was a reform passed by Congress. It did not emerge through self-regulation by doctors. Ending payments from the industry to physicians is also unlikely to come from self-regulation. We need the people of America through political processes to cure us of this cancer. Okay, let's switch gears from a lot of bad news to some good news. Okay, this from the New York Times. To treat chronic ailments, fix diet first. Last year, California's version of Medicaid, Medi-Cal, introduced a three-year pilot study that's already showing what experts in the healthcare field have seen anecdotally, that tailored nutrition can improve health and lower medical costs for chronically ill patients. The pilot includes specially formulated meals and in-home visits for congestive heart failure patients, which has caused some of the highest rates of hospital readmissions. Project Angel Food, one of six California nonprofits participating in the pilot, delivers such meals. In addition to providing lunch and dinner and a nutritional guide for every meal, nutritionists show clients how to portion their meals and when they're ready to transition off the program, how to shop for food and cook for themselves. Most of the restrictions eliminate saturated fats and emphasize whole grains, in addition to limiting sodium and fluids. In congestive heart failure particularly, the body can no longer maintain an appropriate balance between sodium and water. For lower income patients who may often rely on canned or prepared foods, this can feel overwhelming, especially if they don't have the means to start shopping for healthy fresh food and cooking it from scratch. Medi-Cal patients were chosen for the pilot because in general they frequently use the healthcare system. Data from 2017 shows that of California's Medicaid patients with congestive heart failure who are discharged from the hospital, a third return in less than a month. Published estimates of average hospital stays for those with the condition range between 5 to 6 days, with cost estimates between $10,000 to $15,000 per stay. But self-reported statistics show a mere 6.2% readmission rate after 30 days for the 404 participants enrolled in the Medi-Cal pilot. Another body of research, however, is showing that medically tailored meals can go a long way toward reversing that downward health spiral. A retrospective cohort study headed by Seth Berkowitz, MD, at the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill School of Medicine and published recently concluded, participation in a medically tailored meals program appears to be associated with fewer hospital and skilled nursing admissions and less overall medical spending. Maximal compliance with drug therapy doesn't keep congestive heart failure patients out of the hospital without dietary adherence, Dr. Hussein said. So providing medically tailored meals is a potentially easy win all around. Sick or elderly patients can stay home and remain independent, while reduced hospital admission dramatically reduces healthcare costs and overall burden in the system. Okay, one step, integrating nutrition better into the interface with medicine. Of course, we can do it even farther back in the road with more primary prevention, people just eating well in general before they get deathly ill. Okay, next up from Science Daily. Study found focusing on patients' values instead of problems offered better results. Patients with complex needs, serious mental and physical health problems, and substance use disorders flock to emergency rooms, costing the healthcare system billions every year. A new study suggests a non-traditional approach to these patients can significantly improve their daily functioning and health outcomes. In crisis and with nowhere to turn, thousands of patients with complex needs every year flock to emergency rooms in Harris County, Texas, and across the country. Referred to as high need, high cost, these patients have limited ability to take care of themselves, making it challenging for doctors to find effective treatments. Their health problems are mostly left unresolved, and they consistently return to the ERs, costing the health system billions every year. The ERs are not designed to address chronic medical or acute social problems such as homelessness, hunger, and job loss. New research suggests a non-traditional approach to these patients can significantly improve their daily functioning and health outcomes. Complicating matters, patients with a number of different diagnoses typically visit multiple medical and social service agencies, hospital systems, health clinics, food pantries, shelters, with no collective record available to each organization. This can lead to both gaps and overlapping services, resulting in higher costs and insufficient care. The diagnostic-based approach, telling patients what's wrong and here's how to fix it before sending them on their way, coupled with a lack of information about where they've been, has worked spectacularly badly for underserved populations who already have reason not to trust us, said Dr. David Buck, Associate Dean for Community Health at the University of Houston College of Medicine. We need to find a better way to not only lower healthcare costs, but more importantly, improve their quality of life. In a study published in the journal Population Health Management, Buck and his research team reported a novel intervention that integrates a psychological, values-based approach with coordinated care management, significantly helped improve daily functioning, including money management, personal hygiene, social connectivity, and relationships for this vulnerable group of patients. The values-based approach to care was applied to 18 high-need, high-cost patients at the Patient Care Intervention Center in Houston, a nonprofit organization founded by Buck. Over the course of 6 months, care coordinators worked with the patients to identify their values and associated goals as a way to start meaningful discussions and ultimately engage them in appropriate care. Buck calls it a way of centering providers on who or what is most important to the patient through a cognitive behavioral therapy informed approach. Instead of focusing on their problems, we focus on their values and goals. Instead of the push and pull of doctors telling patients not to do something for the sake of their health, we look at who and what is most important to the client. It's trust building and a way to reach the root of the problem. The nonprofit also integrates millions of service utilization records from medical and social service agencies through its comprehensive health record system called the Unified Care Continuum Platform. By linking data from patient visits, the researchers wrote, communication gaps between agencies that often work independently are bridged to provide a complete view of utilization and needs, as well as identify common clients and service gaps in the community. This helps to overcome systemic barriers to health that might exist and reduce duplication of services. Buck recalls a patient with HIV and bipolar disorder who showed up in emergency rooms every few days. The patient racked up more than $1 million in bills. No one was successful in engaging him. He hated the ERs, but he was in crisis, said Buck, who discovered that the patient's dog was his main motivation. The patient left his dog tied up and alone for days whenever he went to the hospital. Instead of just demanding he get on his meds, we discussed what was not working for him. Instead of getting in the medical zone, we would go back to the dog. He didn't like leaving his best friend behind. We would ask what was getting in the way of his value to be good to his dog. He identified his need to get primary care for his chronic illnesses rather than acute crisis care. This approach gives people the power to decide how they need to behave instead of being told. The patient now regularly visits a primary care clinic, avoiding the emergency room. Buck said if the intervention could positively impact even the most challenging patients, it has implications for improving health care for everyone. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-